considering the nature of the various American colonies to the crown or to the King of England, it is important to realize that for them the relationship was essentially feudal. Now, feudalism has a very long history. In fact, we are still living to a great extent amidst some of the relics and forms of feudalism. Our federal structure is essentially a feudal structure. The United States is the most feudal country in the world in that our government has various levels: federal, state, county, municipal, or township, all of which diversify, decentralize, and grade governments on various levels. Now, for countless centuries, the kings of Europe were feudal monarchs. As feudal monarchs, they had an obligation towards all those lords and all those people who were under them to provide certain services and defenses. And those under them had certain obligations to them as their feudal king. However, as the Renaissance developed and the modern age began to dawn, the theory of kingship changed from a feudal theory to a very different thing, an absolutist theory. Absolutism means that an absolutist theory of monarchy means that the king is absolute lord and sovereign, and that there is no greater power than himself. His authority is total, his power is total, and he is like a god. Now, a part of absolutism was the theory of the divine right of kings. The king was seen as a kind of god on earth. And if the king said that right was wrong and wrong was right, it was permissible for him to do so. The king could take your life without any need for justification. He could supersede all laws, wipe out all your rights. He was like a god on earth. His power was total. But unlike God, his nature was not necessarily righteous. As a result of this change, the kings increasingly began to exercise more and more power. And in England, it led first of all to the Civil War and Cromwell fighting against the absolutism of the crown. Then when Charles II came to the throne, he did not attempt to exercise the absolutism, but when his brother, James II, who succeeded him, began to rule as an absolutist monarch, the end result was the Glorious Revolution of 1688, the overthrow of James II, William and Mary came in, 1688. And as a result, the absolutist theory of monarchy was overthrown in England. However, absolutism was increasingly claimed by Parliament instead, so that in the 1940s and 50s, when the Labour government took over in England, Sir Hartley Shawcross, Attorney General of Great Britain, actually made the statement that Parliament's power was absolute. Parliament could order all blue-eyed babies destroyed at birth, and there was no power to overrule Parliament. Absolutism is still with us. The Marxist countries are not only absolutist in theory, but in practice. It means the totalitarian power of the government. Now, as I indicated, the British Crown for some time claimed absolutist powers. Very definitely, this was true under the Tudor monarchs. Henry VIII, Mary, Elizabeth, then the Stuarts, James I, Charles I, through James II. All the same, however, the elements of feudal monarchy were not entirely gone. When the colonies were established, they were established on the pattern of feudalism. And their relationship to the crown was a feudal and a chartered relationship. Now, the colonies were English colonies in the sense that they were established by Englishmen. They were not England's colonies. They were crown colonies, essentially, in that they gained their charters from the crown. Now, there are different kinds of colonies, and one form is crown colonies, but in a sense, all were crown colonies in that all of them derived their charter from the king. This meant that there was no connection between England and the colonies except that they had the same king. At the time of the War of Independence, King George III was King of England, King of Scotland, King of Ireland, King of New York, and King of Virginia, King of Massachusetts, King of North Carolina, South Carolina, and so on. As a result, each of the colonies were more or less an independent country. As an independent country, while they were sister countries to one another and to England, their only legal relationship to each other was through the king. There was no legal connection between Virginia and Pennsylvania. They were independent. They were separate from each other. But they both had the same king. And so they regarded themselves as members of one family, a family of colonies, a family of states. Now, each of these various colonies governed itself, it taxed itself. In every respect, it was an independent country. As a result, each of them elected their own legislators, or whatever they called their legislative body. Each of them governed themselves. In some cases, they even elected their own governor, although he was subject to royal approval. And there was also the power of a royal veto on all legislation. So that when any legislative act was passed, it had to go to London to be approved or vetoed after the governor and the legislators approved of it. Thus, when the United States declared its independence, it did not declare its independence of England. They were not under England, but under George III. We shall deal with the Declaration of Independence, but not this morning, and we shall see wherein it was not a Declaration of Independence from Parliament. They did not recognize the authority of Parliament, but a Declaration of Independence from King George III. Now, one of the problems that preceded the War of Independence was precisely the fact that King George III was turning over some of his powers to Parliament, and Parliament was passing taxes on the colonies. The reason for these taxes was the French and Indian War. The attitude of the people in England and of Parliament was this: this war has been very expensive for us, and we've been fighting a war over there in the colonies against the French. Why shouldn't the colonies pay their share of the expenses? After all, the colonies are paying very little in the way of taxes locally, which was true. And their burden of taxation is so small it is practically nothing, which was true. Therefore, let us pass some taxes and impose them upon the colonies and help make them help pay for their share of the war. Now, of course, the colonies objected to this on two counts. First, Parliament had no right to tax them. Only their own legislatures had the right to pass taxes over them. And so the various acts, the Stamp Act and the other acts of taxation, were bitterly resented by the colonists. Just as we would resent it today if, say, the Canadian Parliament decided Americans should pay a tax. It was a foreign body. Parliament was not their legislative body. And so they fought bitterly against the tax. They resented it. They denied the right of Parliament to tax them. And they spoke against taxation without representation. It was not that they wanted representation in Parliament. They were saying that any taxation they had should come from their own representatives. Their representatives in the Virginia House or the Massachusetts House, not in Parliament. That was one very serious aspect of contention. Second, the colonists felt, the idea that we got off free is ridiculous. Where was the fighting? It was right here, a great deal of the fighting in the French and the Indian War. It was not only abroad, but it was here. And the English were gaining a great deal. They were conquering French territories, which we aren't getting necessarily. They were capturing and confirming their hold on Canada and on various territories in the Middle West. And perhaps we're not paying as much taxes, but we did a great deal of the fighting. It was our men, as well as troops from Britain. And it was our women and children who were scalped and killed when the French turned loose the Indian allies they had against us. And so the American colonies were intensely bitter. What makes the English think we're getting away cheaply? How would they like it if the French, with their Indian allies, came swooping down upon their towns, burned their homes, killed their wives and children, and left them as scalped remains? Would they feel that it was an easy thing just because our taxes are not as great as their taxes? And if we govern more efficiently than they do and have lower taxes, is that something we should be punished for? As a result, the colonies resisted the attempt to tax them. When they finally declared their independence, it was of King George III, and they never mentioned Parliament directly in the Declaration of Independence. Now, we're going to turn to another document for the rest of this morning, and we're going to consider it rather carefully and in great detail, because in some respects, it's the best single document for understanding the constitutional and the legal issues between the colonies and England. This is a document that was composed right here in this county. Does anyone know the name of it? What? No. Anyone else know? The sad fact, it's one of the most important documents in American history, and it's rarely ever considered. And yet, to understand the War of Independence, you need to know this. The Fairfax County Resolves. The Fairfax County Resolves. And men like George Washington and George Mason and other men of Virginia gathered together right here in Fairfax in the courthouse, and they met, and they drew up a legal bill of complaints going into why it was necessary to declare their independence. Now, of course, they did not at this point declare their independence, but you cannot understand the Declaration of Independence without the Fairfax County Resolves, in which they set forth their legal arguments. Now, the Resolves begin thus. At a general meeting of the freeholders and inhabitants of the county of Fairfax, on Monday, the 18th day of July, 1774, at the courthouse, George Washington, chairman, and Robert Harrison, clerk of the said meeting. 1. Resolved that this colony and dominion of Virginia cannot be considered as conquered territory. And if it was that the present inhabitants are the descendants, not of the conquered, but of the conquerors. That the same was not settled at the national expense of England, but at the private expense of the adventurers, our ancestors, by solemn compact with and under the auspices and protection of the British Crown, upon which we are in every respect dependent as the people of Great Britain, and in the same manner subject to all His Majesty's just, legal, and constitutional prerogatives. In other words, it's not an absolute monarchy. That our ancestors, when they left their native land and settled in America, brought with them, even if the same had not been confirmed by charters, the civil constitution and form of government of the country they came from, and were by the laws of nature and nations entitled to all its privileges, immunities, and advantages, which have descended to us, their posterity, and ought of right to be as fully enjoyed as if we had still continued within the realm of England. In other words, right off the bat, the men of Fairfax County declared, we are not conquered territory. How can we be treated as though we are conquered? We are the conquerors. Our forefathers came here at their own expense. They conquered this wilderness. They brought with them all the rights of Englishmen. Their only relationship to England is that King George III is their legal sovereign and monarch. But they have full rights under him. They are feudal. They are contractual. They are constitutional. So that England has no more right to rule over Virginia then Virginia has a right to rule over England. As a result, they saw themselves as a sister dominion to England and subject together with England to the British Crown in terms of a constitution. Then they went on to say, number 2, resolve. That the most important and valuable part of the British Constitution, upon which its very existence depends, is the fundamental principle of the peoples being governed by no laws to which they have not given their consent by representatives freely chosen by themselves, who are affected by the laws they enact equally with their constituents, to whom they are accountable, and whose burdens they share, in which consists the safety and happiness of the community. For if this part of the Constitution was taken away or materially altered, the government must degenerate either into an absolute and despotic monarchy or a tyrannical aristocracy, and the freedom of the people be annihilated. Now, this is plain language, very important language. Now, isn't it interesting that you don't ever get this in the history books today? Here it is, one of the most important documents, and it gives the legal basis of the American resistance. What they are saying is, we are not revolutionists. We are men who have a constitutional right to our freedom. And no one has a right to pass laws over us that our own representatives did not enact. The resolves do not ask for representation in Congress. What they are saying is, we have our own representatives here in Virginia, and Virginians can only obey laws passed by Virginians, not by Parliament. Then, the third of the Fairfax resolves. Resolved, therefore, as the inhabitants of the American colonies are not, and from their situation cannot be represented in the British Parliament, that the legislative power here can of right be exercised only by our own provincial assemblies or parliaments, subject to the assent or negative of the British Crown, to be declared within some proper limited time. But as it was thought just and reasonable that the people of Great Britain should reap advantages from these colonies, adequate to the protection they afforded them, the British Parliament have claimed and exercised the power of regulating our trade and commerce, so as to restrain our importing from foreign countries such articles as they could furnish us of their own growth or manufacture, or exporting to foreign countries such articles and portions of our produce as Great Britain stood in need of for her own consumption or manufactures. Such a power directed with wisdom and moderation seems necessary for the general good of that great body politic of which we are a part, although in some degree repugnant to the principles of the Constitution. Under this idea, our ancestors submitted to it. The experience of more than a century during the government of His Majesty's royal predecessors has proved its utility, and the reciprocal benefits flowing from it produced mutual, uninterrupted harmony and goodwill between the inhabitants of Great Britain and her colonies, who during that long period always considered themselves as one and the same people. And though such a power is capable of abuse, and in some instances has been stretched beyond the original design and institution, yet to avoid strife and contention with our fellow subjects, and strongly impressed with the experience of mutual benefits, we always cheerfully acquiesced in it, while the entire regulation of our internal policy and giving and granting our own money were preserved to our provincial legislatures. Now, we discussed mercantilism last night, and we saw that mercantilism was a kind of a socialistic economic structure that required the colonies to provide their raw materials to the mother country, and the mother country's goods to be sold to the colony, and the colony, therefore, should not buy from foreign countries. In this third resolve, Washington and the other men of Fairfax County said, "We don't like this necessarily, but since we are a part of Great Britain as a sister country to England, we have submitted to it, even though we have felt it is unjust. We've not been happy with it. We feel sometimes it has been unfair, But we've done it because, in spite of these things, we are more or less one community. And we have helped our mother country. But this does not give Parliament any right beyond that. It has no power over our internal affairs, only over things external. And even there, while they say, to a degree, we will submit to these mercantilist policies, we're not saying they're altogether just. What we are emphatically saying is that anything within Virginia can only be governed by Virginians, never by Parliament. Then, the fourth resolve. We're going to go through these resolves carefully because you cannot understand the War of Independence apart from these resolves. Fourth resolve. That it is the duty of these colonies on all emergencies to contribute in proportion to their abilities, situation, and circumstances to the necessary charge of supporting and defending the British Empire of which they are part. That while we are treated upon an equal footing with our fellow subjects, the motives of self-interest and preservation will be of sufficient obligation, as was evident through the course of the last war. And that no argument can be fairly applied to the British Parliament's taxing us upon a presumption that we should refuse a just and reasonable contribution, but will equally operate in justification of the executive power taxing the people of England upon a supposition of their representative refusing to grant the necessary supplies. Now here they say, we are a part of the British Empire. We are a sister country to all the others. Virginia is a sister country to New York and England and to Scotland and Ireland and Massachusetts. We are ready, any time the British Empire is attacked, to do our part to defend it, and we did in the last war. But we are on an equal footing with our fellow subjects. A Virginian is equal to a New Yorker and equal to an Englishman. They have no right then in Parliament to treat us as though we were subject. Then the fifth resolve. Resolve that the claim lately assumed and exercised by the British Parliament of making all such laws as they think fit to govern the people of these colonies and to extort from us our money without our consent is not only diametrically contrary to the first principles of the Constitution and the original compacts by which we are dependent upon the British Crown and government, but is totally incompatible with the privileges of a free people and the natural rights of mankind, and will render our legislatures merely nominal and nugatory, and is calculated to reduce us from a state of freedom and happiness to slavery and misery. Thus, Parliament is unconstitutional. If we allow Parliament to govern the internal affairs of Virginia and of Fairfax County, we will lose our freedom and we will become slaves. Then, sixth, resolve that taxation and representation are in their nature inseparable, that the right of withholding or of giving and granting their own money is the only effectual security of a free people against the encroachments of despotism and tyranny, and that whenever they yield the one, they must quickly fall a prey to the other. No taxation without representation. The two must go together. We have no representation in Parliament, and we do not want it. Therefore, the only power that can tax us is the Virginia House, no one else. And this is a fundamental principle of the American War of Independence. Number seven, resolve that the powers over the people of America now claimed by the British House of Commons, in whose election we have no share, on whose determinations we can have no influence, whose information must always be defective and often false, who in many instances may have a separate and in some an opposite interest to ours, and who are removed from those impressions of tenderness and compassion arising from personal intercourse and connections which soften the rigors of the most despotic government, must it continue to establish the most grievous and intolerable species of tyranny and oppression that ever was inflicted upon mankind. And so on the seventh, they continue this point and say, if there is no taxation without, if there is taxation without representation, it's going to lead to tyranny. It means anyone can govern over us who has no awareness of what our own form of life is, what our problems are. Can you see the importance of the Fairfax resolves? Well, here you have the whole constitutional basis of the War of Independence. Can you begin to guess why it is no longer in our history books? It's simply because we don't care about constitutionalism anymore. If we did, we would be studying the Fairfax resolves as much as we study the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. It's that important to our history. And it was formed right here in the Fairfax County Courthouse. I suspect there's not even a sign commemorating it, is there? Does anyone know? No. All right, the eighth resolve. Resolve that it is our greatest wish and inclination, as well as interest, to continue our connection with and dependence upon the British government. But though we are its subjects, we will use every means which heaven hath given us to prevent our becoming its slaves. That's a beautiful statement. We're ready to be faithful subjects of King George. We have no desire to start a revolution or anything, but we will use every means heaven provides us from becoming slaves. Now, that's the way the men of Fairfax County saw it in 1774. We are not going to be slaves. We are free men under God. And we will do everything possible to maintain our freedom. We are subjects, not slaves. Well, before we continue the rest of the Fairfax resolves, we have time for a quick question before the end of the period in about a minute and a half or 2 minutes. Does anyone have a question? Yes.
Was Georgia under Parliament's power? Didn't they get money from Parliament to set up the colonies?
No. All the colonies, whatever went into their beginning, now Georgia had a different origin, ultimately became independent colonies. So that each of them had a chartered form of government. So that Parliament actually had no legal right over any of them. Any other questions? Let's see, I think, is there a bell that rings at 10 of or not? Well, then you may go to your next class.